journey into the Bible and explore its hidden text and rich wisdom. Join Adel Kazilski Mondays at 1 p.m. for the trip of a lifetime.
Shavua Tor 101.9 Chai FM listeners, this is Adel Kazilski. It's Mystical Texts, and I'm with you for the next three quarters of an hour, as I always do on a Monday, learning biblical texts. Last week we spoke a lot about the idea that we've been discussing, and that is that many times we find ourselves between a rock and a hard place. And we are not to go into trauma. We are not to go becoming fearful, being frightened, running away, trying to bury our head in the sand. But rather, we need to do the commandment that God tells us, and that is the commandment of Ve'yitza'u, that we need to travel. And that means, basically, in modern language, we need to move forward. We need to do what we need to do, and we need to put our trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in Hashem, that He will make a plan around everything else. It's not for us to try to think that we are the flight controllers. I always have this joke when I speak to other women. I said each and every single one of us are like, you know, the people that work there at O.R. Tambo in the tower, trying to control every plane, where it's going to land, how it's going to land, what time it's going to land, et cetera, et cetera. We're not that. We should just like leave the controlled tower and throw away the keys and leave it all up to Hashem. And truly, when we do that, we see incredible miracles and we see things that happen before us that are quite astounding. And for those that are skepticals and those that listen to me and like just roll their eyes, even if it's heavenward, I won't say anything about that. or sound all skeptical, we are living in incredible, incredible times. We are living in miraculous times. We are living in the times of the birth pangs of Mashiach. And I think it is Rabbi Nachman of Breslev. I stand to be corrected if anybody listening wants to correct me on that. And please feel free. I think I'm quoting the right Hasidic Rebbe. Said that the end of days, the greatest test that we are going to have is the test of emunah, of faith, and that we are going to be shaken here and there, and it's like us holding onto a cord, like an umbilical cord to Hashem, and somebody is like rattling that piece of rope at the top, and we are being flung in 50 million directions below. But the way that we are going to stay clinging to Hashem is just by holding onto the cord of faith and emunah. And that really is our stance today, our stance against the horrific and unjustified anti-Semitism that we have seen come around, against the false propaganda and the stories that have been weaved in the media. And at the same breath, while we are holding onto our emunah and our bitochen, we are seeing incredible, incredible miracles. Just in the last month and a bit, we've seen the incredible miracle of the attack from Iran, where nobody got hurt. Last week, I spoke about a missile that landed up in the middle of Beersheba, where no children got hurt because a wind blew. There are many, many individual miracles that are coming out of soldiers finding things and circumstances changing, where you can see Yad Hashem. And certainly this weekend, not denigrating the death of people, but we have seen the failure and the destruction of the butchermen of Tehran. Now, nobody in their wildest minds would have, if we were in control, think that this would perhaps be an outcome. But if we put our trust in Hashem, we believe in Hashem. We know that we need to travel forward. We just need to do what we need to do. And just by the way, for those that are still a little bit confused as to what we need to do, we need to serve Hashem. We need to be agents of morality, of goodness, of kindness. We need to do mitzvot. We need to be proudly Jewish. We need to be a light unto the nations. And if we do all of those things, then Hashem can, because He can. He is a being that is omniscient, that he can do whatever he needs to do, and he basically runs the world. He can easily get rid of our enemies without us even lifting a finger. And the breaking news now, just coming out right now, it's actually quite incredible. As we speak, the news coming out is that the butchman from Tehran has died in a helicopter crash. Now, we can again use our practical minds to go and say, but maybe it's this and maybe it's that, it's maybe this and it's maybe that. There's no coincidences in life, and there is a greater force running the world. And that is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is Hashem. And so we thank Hashem for saving us from this butcherman of Tehran who has got so much blood on his hands, it's inconceivable. And it kind of like takes me back to the story of Purim, where eventually we start seeing Haman and his 10 sons being hung at the gallows for their terrible desire to destroy humanity, to destroy to everybody. So thank you, Hashem, for showing your hand once again. I'm not sorry that there is no longer a human being called the butcherman of Tehran. It is not only that we are relieved of this despot, but there are many, many, many Iranians that are celebrating right now, because it is horrible. It is inconceivable. It is just not normal to live under such tyranny. So thank you, Hashem, for what you've done yesterday. Right, so we're going to go back again into biblical text, and we are going to look now, sadly, at the demise of the Egyptian empire, and the last final blow that basically sealed that coffin, and understand that throughout history, this was done many, many, many times on behalf of the Jews, and that's why we are an eternal people, and that's why we are here today. So stay tuned. If you'd like to join the conversation or you'd like to pass a comment, 34519 is our SMS line, 061-895-1019 is our Telegram number.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This is Adel Kozlowski, this is Mystical Text, and this, of course, is 101.9 Hi FM. And we are going to be looking inside chapter 14, verse 21. We're at the point where the sea is going to split. Vayet Moshe et yado. Moshe lifts up his hand. Al hayam, over the sea. Remember, we spoke about the fact that we were told that Moshe was to throw away his stick and, in fact, to use his hand so that everybody could see that this was, in fact, a miracle that came directly from himself. So he lifts his hand over the sea. Vayolech Hashem et hayam beruach kadim aza kol halayla. God drove back the sea with a powerful east wind all of that night. Vayasem et yado lechava beyibaku hamayim. And he transformed the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So basically what this verse is saying, verse 21 of chapter 14, that as soon as Moses lifted his hands over the sea, a powerful east wind began to blow. And we are told that this is the wind that God uses to punish the wicked. It blew the entire night. And just to give you context, this is the seventh night of Pesach. So it was very windy the seventh night of Pesach, but it blew with such strength that it was able to hold back the sea. And then what happened was that the seabed was transformed into dry land and the waters were divided. Now, one reason for this wind was so that the Egyptians would think that the splitting of the sea was in fact a natural phenomenon. And this, of course, was the plan of God, who said to Moses that he was going to harden Pharaoh's heart. So the Egyptians would think that the wind split the sea and that it was not a miracle made specifically for the Jewish people. But there was another result of the wind blowing, And that is that the Egyptians were unable to light lamps or torches, and without that illumination, they were basically rendered helpless all night. They couldn't prepare the attack on the Israelites. So one of the things here, and this comes back to my introduction today, one of the things here is that God always minimizes miracles, right? To the greatest extent possible, he makes use of natural law. And you'll only bend it if it's extremely necessary. And so we go and look at what happened this weekend with the obliteration of the butcher man of Tehran. And it looks and it appears like a natural event, that there was fog, there was dense fog, and there were three helicopters, and the only helicopter that got destroyed was the one that had him inside. Now, again, over here, as with everything else, Hashem's doing it in a natural way. But if we believe that Hashem runs the entire world and that we are in every place in the right time and in the right place because Hashem deems it so, then we see the finger of Hashem here, that this is the way it was supposed to happen. Right, so let's see what happens in verse 22. V'yavo b'nei Yisrael b'toch hayam. The Israelites entered the sea, b'yavasha, it was on dry land. V'hamayim lahem choma miminim u'mismolam. The water was like a wall to them, to their left, and to their right, and to their left. Now, before I start going and describing these walls and describing the various opinions, what we are told in the Midrash is that when they were standing on the seashore, all the tribes began to argue as to who should go first. While they were debating, and you know how Jews are, we debate, it's very robust. If there's 10 Jews, there's 5,000 opinions. So can you imagine when there's 3 million Jews, how many opinions there were? The tribe of Binyamin marched forward into the sea ahead of all the rest. So everybody's having an argument who should go in first. Binyamin went in ahead of everybody else. Seeing this, the leaders of the tribe of Yehuda began to throw stones at them because they believed that they were the leaders. This was just out of a spirit of zealousness of who should have the kavod, who should have the ability to go in first. Now, a good parallel to explain this, the Midrash gives, is a story of a king who had two sons. He had an older son and a younger son. So one night he said to the younger one, make sure you wake me up at sunrise. And to the older one, he said, will you wake me up 9 o'clock in the morning? So as good sons, at sunrise, the young one went up to wake up his father. And the older one stopped him and said, father told me to wake him up at nine. And the younger one said, but dad told me to wake him up at sunrise. And they started fighting. The king woke up from the squabble. The king said, you both wanted to obey my instructions, and therefore I will reward you both. So using that mashal, we can see now Binyamin and Yehuda go loggerheads, and Binyamin is saying, we're going ahead because Hashem said so. Yehuda's going, no, we're going ahead because we're the leaders. We've got to show we're the royalty. So both tribes in truth were amply rewarded because of this, because they both wanted and had a desire to sanctify the name of God and go into the sea first. So how was that? So Binyamin was worthy to have the Shekhinah reside in its portion, because we know that the Beit HaMikdash was half in the portion of Binyamin. But the other part of the Beit HaMikdash was in fact in Yehuda. The Kodesh Kedoshim, just by the way, the Holy of Holies was in the portion of Binyamin. But because Yehuda yelled at Binyamin, the royal line was given to the tribe of Yehuda. Now, this is an opinion of a rabbi called Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda, another commentator, another great rabbi in the times of the Gemara, said none of the tribes actually wanted to go in first. And I've learned that when I was young. was that each of them was waiting for the other. Everybody was too scared. And who actually jumped in? A guy by the name of Nachshon ben Aminadab. He was from the tribe of Yehuda. He jumped into the sea. And by the way, when he jumped, he went all the way up, up to his throat before it actually split. Okay. And because of that, then the whole tribe of Yehuda followed in, and that it says in Tehillim, in chapter 69, in verse 2, there is an interesting verse. I'm actually going to look it up as we are speaking, so I can give you exactly the Hebrew words, but it goes as follows. It says, Hoshieni Elokim, this is in chapter 29 of Tehillim. Hoshieni Elokim ki ba'u ma'im ad nafesh. Save me, Hashem, for the waters are threatening my life. And we are told that this verse was, in fact, the verse that Nachshon ben Aminadab said, because the waters were all the way up to him. Now, we can ask the question as to why this happened. And really the answer is that God was testing the Jews. He said, move forward. Don't wipe out of your mind any type of idea that you are running the world. And just do as I'm told. And sometimes we do that and we still go and see how very, very difficult things are. And it's not, again, it's not very hard, because we tend to fall prey to it all the time. The bottom line is that even today, when we are looking at the situation that we find ourselves as a Jewish people, it seems that so many doors are closed and we try to do so many things. And as I've said before, the answer to all of this is move forward. Just carry on being good people, integrous people, moral people, kind people, people that are keeping Torah and keeping mitzvahs. Just do it. Okay, it could be that we feel that we're drowning, that the water is all the way up to our chins. But that is the test from Hashem to us. That is the test of our emunah. And then Hashem comes and he starts splitting seas for us, like we have seen and like I have spoken. So what we know is that the waters of the sea, so to speak, congealed. They formed protective walls on both sides. And the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire were behind them. So the Jews were perfectly, they were perfectly defended, protected from the Egyptians. Who was the last Jew? If Nachshon ben Aminadab, according to Rabbi Yehuda, was the first Jew to jump in, who was the last Jew to enter into the sea? And the answer is, it was Moshe Rabbeinu. He was the last one to enter in so he could reassure the Jews that the sea would remain divided until everybody had crossed in. If he had gone in first, they might have got afraid and they would have maybe got cold feet and made a U-turn. Also, just going back to the argument between Binyamin and Yehuda, note that both of them and both opinions have merit. It said that because Binyamin, according to Rabbi Meir, was the first tribe to go in, they were worthy of providing the first king to Israel by no other than the name of Saul, Shaul. But because they turned around, they started walking in, and then there's an opinion that they turned around, according to Rabbi Yehuda, the kingdom was taken away from Saul's descendants, from Shaul's descendants, and it was given to David, who was of the tribe of Yehuda, because Yehuda had total sacrifice, and that is how it remained. There are a whole other lot of opinions, and one very, very interesting one is that, and I actually learned it this year while preparing, interestingly, my Pesach table, that in fact there wasn't only one splitting of the sea, but in fact the sea split into 12 different paths, and each tribe walked down one of the paths. And the other very interesting thing that I learned this year, I actually verified it with a map, and to go and see is that they didn't cross the Red Sea, meaning they didn't start on one side and end up on the other side. But in fact, they went in, made a U-turn left, and came out on the same side that they entered in, just much higher on the Red Sea. So really, the Red Sea was only a ploy that was caused in order to see the final destruction of the Egyptians. Now, what I want to share with you is the 10 miracles that happened at Yam Suf, at the sea, and the 10 plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians. So let's understand those. So there were 10 different miracles. Let's talk about the miracles that happened to the Jews. Firstly, just number one, top of the pop, the first miracle is that the water actually split. Number two, it formed a roof-like protection over their head. So you can kind of like almost visualize it as the walls of the sea and then curling up on top. So they had protection on top of them. The third is what I mentioned now, that it was split into 12 individual passageways, one for each of the tribes. The fourth miracle was that the ground was perfectly dry beneath the children of Israel. The fifth miracle, that it was clay under the feet of the Egyptians. This was Midah, Keneged Midah, to punish the Egyptians for having enslaved the Jews and making them work with clay. The number six was that the water became as hard as a rock, okay, which you will see then will harm the Egyptians. That was a miracle. The seventh was the solidified water formed decorative mosaic walls. Eight, the walls were transparent, allowing each of the tribes to see the others crossing, so everybody would have a sense of security in the crossing. And number nine, if a Jew, while crossing the Yam Suf, became thirsty, he stretched his hand out, the water melted, and it would yield a sweet drinking water. And the tenth miracle was the reverse of that, that as soon as he had quenched his thirst, the wall became a solid mass once more. Now, let's go out and see what happened to the Egyptians, because the Egyptians, and this is the reason why they were wiped out of existence, so to speak, because honestly, if you look at Egypt today, it hasn't really ever risen back in history. They were culpable of seven crimes, and they were idol worship, immorality, bloodshed, oppression and exploitation of their victims, desecration of God's name, conceit, and slander. And again, if you listen, how the Egyptians were wiped out of existence because of these things, I just bear the question open. Who today is acting out of a sense of idol worship, immorality, bloodshed, oppression, exploitation of their victims, desecration of God's name, conceit, and slander? I don't think I have to answer it. You can all answer it yourself. Okay, so let's talk about the 10 plagues by the sea that they were smitten by. Okay, number one. Even when morning dawned, they traveled in the dark because the cloud behind Bnei Israel plunged the Egyptian camp into darkness. Number two, the cloud also caused the ground under their feet to become as soft as clay. And we spoke about that, that it was a miracle for the Jew. It was a curse for the Egyptian, because you can just imagine how it is trying to walk in clay. Three, the pillar of fire that illuminated the way for the children of Israel radiated intense heat to the Egyptians, and it caused the hoofs of their horses to fall off. The fourth curse and terrible thing that happened was because the heat was so intense, it burnt the wheels of the chariots. And basically, you will see as we go through the verse that it would burn off one wheel at a time, making the chariots go completely wobbly. Now, the above mentioned plagues are summed up in the Torah with the words, and you can look in verse 25, which we are going to get to now, but I'm just going to read it. It says over there that Hashem drove the Egyptians in a hard manner. And this was to indicate that Paro here was being punished with these plagues, Meda Keneged Meda, for having hardened his heart. But let's finish up the last six before we go to the break. Since the horses' hooves were fallen off, the Egyptians tumbled off their chariots. They fell into the mud. And once they were in the mud, they were unable to get up. The sixth plague was when the water came gushing towards the Egyptians. No Egyptian was able to flee. Wherever he was, a wave came rolling towards him. The seventh was that Hashem took the Egyptians like someone who turns a pot upside down, and they tumbled into the sea. And even once they had sunk into the ocean, the lower waters threw them back up to the upper waters, and then the upper waters threw them back down to the depths. The eighth plague was that some of the Egyptians were covered by the earth at the bottom of the sea. The ninth was some sank down into the water as fast as lead. That was a, by the way, a quick and merciful death. Of the better Egyptians, the wicked ones were tossed around in the sea, up and down, dying a slow and painful death. And finally, the last plague was that the sea vomited up, cast out the corpses of the Egyptians onto the shore for all of Bnei Israel to see. Pretty gruesome.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
You are speaking with, you can speak to me, by the way, on 34519, that's the SMS line, 0618951019 is the Telegram number, but I'm speaking with you right now. Seems like I'm doing all the speaking. Love you to do some. We are speaking about what happened to the Jews and the Egyptians at the splitting of the sea. I just want to just touch on the last point, the last miracle that, well, the last plague that happened to the Egyptians, and just expand a little bit more on that. And that is that we said that the sea cast the corpse of the Egyptians onto the shores for all the Jews to see. Now, why would God do that? You know, we can apply vengeance, we can apply punishment, we don't have to make it so bad. Why is it that God did that? Well, there were four reasons. Number one, the Jews were not convinced that the Egyptians had actually perished. They were so traumatized, they thought that the Egyptians would emerge from the Yam Suf again on the other side. And God considered the skepticism of Bnei Israel, which really was a rebellion against them, but to assuage their fears, he allowed them to see the Egyptian bodies. The second one was that the Egyptians that were really bad were bopping up and down and up and down, and they were able to go and see that the Jews, in fact, had not been hit at all, that they had not perished in the Yam Suf. Thirdly, those that floated ashore allowed the Bnei Israel to take their spoils. And fourthly, the Jews were able to rebuke the dying Egyptians for having wronged them. But that really is a little bit more of an expounding on why they could see the corpses coming out onto the shore. Now, the most famous question, what happened to good old King Paro? Well, one opinion said that he was kept alive until last. He watched his entire army drown. He watched the witness of the Jewish people, and then he too finally drowned. That's what the Midrash says. However, interestingly, there's another view that he watched all of this. He watched his entire army drown. He watched the Israelites live and witness their joy, but he then survived. He was thrown back out of the sea on the first side that he went to. He never returned to Egypt. We're told that he actually lived in exile, and in fact, that he did tshuva. This is according to the opinion of Pirkei Rebbe Eliezer. And the Pirkei Rebbe Eliezer says the following. Paroi is a living proof of the great power of tshuva. Because when he was suffering in the midst of the ocean, He admitted the truth of Hashem's power, which he had formerly denied again and again and again. And consequently, God spared him. And where did Paro run to? Said he never went back to Egypt. He certainly couldn't, because he had egg all over his face. He actually, interestingly, ran to a place called Nineveh. And that's where he became king. Now, that should ring bells for you, because who was the king of Nineveh? He was the ruler to whom the prophet Jonah, remember Jonah and the whale? Nineveh was a very bad city. Jonah was sent to the king of Nineveh to tell him to do tshuva. And truthfully, at the end, Nineveh wasn't destroyed because the king and all the people did tshuva. And so we learn from here that even the most wicked of the wicked, if they come to a realization that God is king of this world, that he is the power, he is the one that is ruling the world, running the world, and doing everything, well, then that's what it is. Right, let's read the verses, because I kind of like was giving you the whole story in the Midrash. Let's just corroborate it with the verses. Let's look at verse 23. V'yedefu Mitzrayim. The Egyptians gave chase, v'yabo acharehim, and they came after them. Kosos paro richbo farshav el tochayam. All of Pharaoh's horses, his chariot corps, and his cavalry came into the middle of the sea. Vayhi ba'ashmoret ha'boker, and it was in the morning, it was on the morning watch. Vayashkev Hashem el machaneh Mitzrayim. God gazed down at the Egyptian camp. Ba'amud esh anan ba'yahem et machaneh Mitzrayim. He looked through them through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he panicked to the Egyptian camp. How were things being how were they being punished? Because the wind made it very dark, the cloud made it very dark for them, and as we said, the heat was burning burning their tires off. And this is what it says in verse 25. By Yasar it often markvotav, he removed the wheel of the chariots, the in Hahagub and that made them move very, very heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Anusa mitnei Israel, let's run away from these Israelites." Ki Hashem nilcham lahem b'Mitzrayim, God is fighting them. So basically, as we said, the heat of the fire melted the bearings holding the wheels. The wheels fell off. But if you actually go and look at the wheel, the word for wheel, it says often one wheel, which meant that if God had taken all the wheels off, they just would have got stuck in the mud. He let one wheel come off on each chariot, and so they drove in a very haphazard way, and they were being destroyed. Now, there's also the word markvotav of their chariots. The word for chariot, merkava, is also a connotation to a spiritual structure, as in the merkava that we know that is described by the prophet Yecheskel. So when he's saying that he destroyed God, the wheel of the chariot, it denotes that he was also destroying the lower angels of the structure, which means that God was also destroying the spiritual hold that the Egyptians had on the Jews. This was both a physical war and a spiritual one at the same time. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
Hashtag you don't have to be Jewish.
Just one note that I do want to make before we conclude today, and that is that this was a terrible death for the Egyptians. And while on all accounts they deserved every single amount of retribution, and we know that God's judgment is just and he does exactly what is needed, nevertheless, we do not throw fireworks and get totally excited about it. And it is for this reason, because there were deaths of God's of humanity, albeit that they deserved it, we do not recite the full Hallel on the seventh day of Pesach. And in fact, there are different time periods that different angels pray to God. And the morning watch, where this destruction was happening, God stilled the angels so that they should not give praise to God. And we down here on earth, we don't give full praise to God for our redemption. Because at the end of the day, every human being that dies is a tragedy and a pain for God, and for that we respect that. So just, I'm making this comment simply because we are criticized so much about an alleged, us allegedly being a genocidal people. On the contrary, if we were a genocidal people, we could easily have raised the ground on the 8th of October, but we haven't. It's taken us 7 months. We have lost people on our side because we are trying to do this surgically and look after those of humanity that aren't full of retribution. So this again is another example of the way we behave. We're a light unto the nation, a moral nation, and we stand proud. This is Adel Kazilski. This is 101.9 Chai FM. Thank you for joining me.